You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. U.S. Representative Suzanne Bonamici and Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield say they are still fighting for federal grant money that was supposed to help fund a major expansion at an Astoria hospital. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz reports.
Columbia Memorial Hospital is still waiting on $14 million it was awarded through a grant program operated by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The grant was intended to fund various components of a new building to make it resilient in the face of major disasters like earthquakes or tsunamis. The Trump administration abruptly halted the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities, or BRIC, grant program earlier last year. Oregon, along with other states, successfully pursued a lawsuit that kept the Trump administration from using that awarded money somewhere else. But Bonamici, who was on site with Rayfield at Columbia Memorial Hospital Wednesday morning, says there has been almost no communication from FEMA since.
The amount of money that's going to enrich this administration through corruption is outrageous. It makes $14 million here in Columbia Memorial Hospital seem, again, if we don't get this, would be a gross injustice, and I'm going to do everything I can to get that promised funding here to this hospital and be back for the grand opening.
Rayfield says right now they're waiting to see what FEMA will do next. He says if FEMA continues to ignore its obligations to pay out the grant money, Oregon expects to pursue additional legal action. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
Jewell School District received a $200,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to expand its agricultural education program. The district already grows produce in a school garden, but is restricted by seasonal weather and limited growing space. The grant will support the building of a greenhouse, which will increase crop variety, extend the growing season, and allow more school-grown food to be incorporated into the district's national lunch program. The grant requires a 25% local match. Money raised through events hosted by Clatsop Working Watersheds Cooperative and Oregon Women in Timber and designated for the school district will provide that match. Jewell School Superintendent Corey Peterson calls the grant life-changing. He says it will provide students with valuable hands-on experience and career skills. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. For the first time in three decades, Oregon will place limits on campaign contributions next year. Now, some advocates are planning to ask voters to approve a far bigger change. Dirk Vanderhart reports.
A ballot measure being proposed by the group Honest Elections Oregon would eliminate all corporate spending on politics in the state. Everything from multinational giants to tiny nonprofits would be barred from spending money to influence elections. Blocking corporate money from politics has been viewed as impossible since the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision. It found that corporations have a First Amendment right to weigh in on races. But advocates in Oregon and other states have a new legal theory that seeks to sidestep that ruling. They say that since states grant corporations their powers, states can decide to take away the right to spend on politics. The concept is already passed in Hawaii, where it's being challenged in the courts. Voters in Montana will decide whether to follow suit in November. And if advocates in Oregon have their way, voters here will have a say on the matter in 2028. I'm Dirk Vanderhart, reporting.
A state report says President Donald Trump's tariffs have hurt Oregon trade. But JPR's Theo Greenlee reports seafood processors have been dealing with trade barriers for a long time.
Oregon's tariff analysis says the latest trade policies have disrupted exports and created uncertainty for businesses across the state. But Lori Steele, who heads the West Coast Seafood Processors Association, says her industry is no stranger to duties.
It's a mixed bag with the tariffs. There have definitely been concerns about retaliatory tariffs, but these are mostly in countries where we've been dealing with tariffs for a long time.
Steele says commercial seafood processors are more concerned about the state's environmental regulations. I'm Theo Greenlee in Port Orford.
As wildfires burn millions of acres across Oregon, one small community in the Columbia River Gorge may adopt a proactive defense. Mosier residents are deciding whether to work together to conduct controlled burns on private land. OPB's Porter Levinson reports.
Drew Merritt lives in the countryside just outside of Mosier, and he has come face to face with wildfire before. In 2020, the Mosier Creek fire made a run toward his property when he and his wife were away.
We had spent a couple nights camping up in the Gifford Pinchot.
On their way home, their phones lit up.
Just as we got reception is right when we received the reverse 911 call from the county saying there was a fire in the area.
Merritt and his wife raced back to their home above the small plant nursery they run. The air was already smoky. They grabbed their cat, some essentials, and quickly evacuated to Hood River. From there, they watched the fire spread.
We could see it moving up the canyon and trees torching, and it was definitely panic-inducing at that point because it was certainly looking pretty threatening.
He says the fire burned within 300 yards of his property, and he never wants that to happen again. So last month, Merritt went to a meeting in town where dozens of people gathered to talk about forming what's called a prescribed burn association. You've probably heard of prescribed burns on public land. These burns can slow down wildfires by destroying fuels on the forest floor. A prescribed burn association, or PBA, is a community-led effort. Landowners and local agencies work together to conduct controlled burns on private land. They pool knowledge, equipment, and labor.
I think it's important that landowners are able to learn the tools to make their land safer.
Kathy Sleven is a community activist who organized the meeting about starting a PBA in Mosier.
I might be able to help my neighbors. If the fire got to my property and was able to drop down in intensity, it might give the wildland firefighters a chance. It might give my neighbors a chance.
Connor McKibben is the fire captain at the Mosier Fire District. At the meeting, he listened to residents' concerns, like, how could they protect endangered wildlife from burns? How much would this cost? But mostly, what would they do if a prescribed burn escaped? McKibben says that is people's number one concern, that an escape burn could turn into a new wildfire. But McKibben points to data from U.S. Forest Service burns, which shows that's unlikely.
Fires escaping control line is not so rare, but fires getting completely out of control and causing damage is less than 1% of prescribed burns wind up having an escape fire to that degree.
And he says good planning can mitigate fire and smoke risks. He supports forming a prescribed burn association in Mosier.
It's only a net positive by improving fire defensibility. If I can help do those things at cost and encourage more people to get involved, then it's going to make my job easier, everybody's lives safer, and property safer. And that makes me feel good.
McKibben has already helped one guy in town conduct a prescribed burn on his land. Preston Booker didn't even own a chainsaw before moving to Mosier last year, but the property he bought was overgrown and thick with underbrush. Preparing for the burn was a ton of work.
First steps were a lot of decluttering, just pulling out dead wood, limbing as much as I could prior to the prescribed burn, and I did that nonstop for like 2 months.
On the day of the burn, he helped a hired crew cut brush and fire lines.
Yeah, I just got in and it was one of the hardest working days of my life.
Booker says the change after the burn was remarkable, with new grass growing where underbrush had been. And he changed too.
I went from not being a forester to kind of being a very okay amateur forester, I think, in about 2 months.
There are 9 prescribed burn associations in Oregon, and Booker hopes Mosier will be next, so more landowners like him can connect to the tools and volunteers they need to conduct controlled burns at home. Porter Levinson, OPB.
More sockeye are swimming up the lower Yakima River. That's after heavy machinery removed a land bridge that blocked the river's flow. NWPB's senior environmental correspondent Courtney Flatt has the story.
It's been about 6 months since excavators scooped out the Bateman Island Causeway in the Tri-Cities. The stagnant water behind the earthen land bridge could get really hot in the summer and created space for predators to snack on salmon. Now that the water is no longer blocked, biologists say they've seen an increase in sockeye salmon in the lower Yakima River, almost 400 sockeye. That's with surprisingly low sockeye numbers elsewhere and a years-long drought. Zach Sakavish is a research biologist with the Yakima Nation. He says sockeye need to move quickly during hot months.
Having that causeway out allows them to just cue in and boogie.
Sakavish says these sockeye numbers are likely the highest percentage since the Yakima Nation first released sockeye for its reintroduction program in 2009. I'm Courtney Flatt in Richland, Washington.
A judge ruled this week that the federal government hasn't done enough to protect the coastal marten, the weasel-like carnivore which was listed as threatened in 2020. The Center for Biological Diversity filed a lawsuit 2 years ago, arguing the government has delayed its environmental analysis. Tala DiBenedetto is an attorney at the center.
With those analyses comes mitigation, ways for the agency to make informed decisions on how to manage the area to best protect martens and their habitat.
The lawsuit focuses on the area around 70 martens that live on the Oregon Dunes National Recreation Area, where off-road vehicle use could be a major threat to the species. The judge has ordered some areas of the dunes to be closed, a curfew established for off-road vehicles, and a temporary ban on future off-road event permits until the government does its environmental study. The state's whale watching center in Depot Bay is shut down for repairs, but officials say it'll reopen by the end of October. Christian Fodenvenzel reports.
The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department's Whale Watching Center was built in 1956 and allows visitors to walk up to the roof to get a good view of the passing leviathans. But the roof promenade has been leaking and is being repaired. Park spokesman Mike Baden says, meanwhile, there are plenty of other places to see wildlife.
Yeah, nearby parks such as Boiler Bay and Rocky Creek and Cape Foulweather are also fantastic for whale watch viewing.
The building was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 2012. Authorities are aiming to have repairs finished in time for the winter's whale watching migration. I'm Christian Fodenvenzel reporting.
You're listening to KMUN. You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Now moving to news from Washington. Undeveloped land costs soared in Pacific County in the year since the COVID-19 pandemic. Undeveloped property that went for between $50,000 to $99,000 nearly doubled following the pandemic. Before the pandemic, most undeveloped land countywide sold for fewer than $50,000, according to the Pacific County's assessor's office. The share of undeveloped land that went for fewer than $20,000 plummeted, from being the majority to just more than a quarter of all sales from the last 4 years. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. A group that's been working for years to help address the opioid epidemic in Pierce County is being quietly shut down. Local officials claim it's the right time to end the Tacoma-Pierce County Opioid Task Force, but some addiction advocates have their doubts. KNKX's Mitch Borden has the story.
More than 200 people gathered last year for the Opioid Task Force's annual summit to strategize how to help locals struggling with addiction. Pierce County Councilmember Janie Hitchin described the driving force behind their work.
We care about the first responders who are responding to overdoses again and again and again and just frustrated. We care about the community members that can't find shelter and can't find help. We care.
But this year, there won't be an opioid summit because the task force was officially disbanded in June. The group was launched as a shared regional response to the opioid crisis in 2018, largely made up of volunteers. It helped local organizations coordinate their addiction services, distributed the overdose reversal medication naloxone, and worked to make treatment easier to access. It also advised local leaders on how to use millions of dollars in opioid settlement funds. The Tacoma-Pierce County Health Department helped manage the task force. Elizabeth Allen is with the health department and says this work was important, but it was time for the initiative to end.
At some point, you have to say, okay, so we have met, we have discussed, we've organized everything. Now let's move forward.
Over the last 7 years, according to the health department, Pierce County and Tacoma invested more than $1.2 million into the task force. That helped pay for things like support staff and events. Now, local opioid funds are being put towards direct services. Allen says the health department will focus on behavioral health programs, and it's expanding its street medicine team.
Part of all that is being able to hand out naloxone, being able to connect people to those resources within the community, you know, as well as serving in that medical capacity too for support.
Allen says this shift in approach was organic since the task force was so effective.
We completed our work in terms of what our goals were. We wanted that collaborative, coordinated effort. We wanted to show awareness, and we were very successful in that.
None of us are happy about this and are quite dismayed and actually in some level quite disgusted.
Joe Contras is a behavioral health therapist and served on the task force for years. He says the decision to dissolve the group was unexpected, but public health officials point to a drop in overdose deaths across the county in the last quarter of 2025 as a sign the task force is no longer needed. However, according to state data, opioid deaths were actually up overall last year. More than 300 people died. Still, health officials say drug-related deaths are slowing down. Contras says even if that's true, it doesn't mean the task force should be disbanded.
I don't buy that. I just think that's a cop-out, because we've seen some improvement, we don't need to do this anymore. We probably should do it more.
He says a huge part of what they did was creating space for addiction service providers to regularly meet, get to know one another, and brainstorm. According to him, this made it easier for them to help patients find treatment that best suited their needs.
Partnership and just a kind of coordinated approach, coordinated conversations, coordinated efforts, all of those things are lost now.
Paul Lukoski leads the Tacoma Needle Exchange and previously served on the task force. He says a drop in overdose deaths in Pierce County could have been caused by a number of things, such as naloxone being much more accessible than it was in the past.
You have to look more deeply into the data. It's not as easy as saying that deaths are down, and so we're going to start rolling back.
Lukoski says shutting down the task force sends the wrong message.
You know, when you disband the opioid task force, there's kind of this unwritten belief that it doesn't warrant special attention anymore.
Local leaders say addressing the opioid crisis is still a priority. And even though the task force has been disbanded, some of its members are trying to figure out how they can continue its work. I'm Mitch Borden, reporting.
Anybody visiting the Ballard Locks around 5 o'clock on Tuesday racked up some major PNW points when several orcas made a rare visit, delighting onlookers.
Wow, orcas in the locks.
This is literally a sighting of a lifetime.
Oh, for sure.
I've never even heard of them coming down there.
No.
That sound is from Perry Erickson Brown, who shared the encounter on Instagram. Photos online show as many as 5 orcas swimming through the locks. Field biologist and director of Salish Wildlife Watch, Kirsty Moule, says these were transient Biggs killer whales that made their way south from Whidbey Island. A spokesperson for the locks says that orcas have previously been spotted in Shilshul Bay, but Monday is the first time in recent memory they've come this close to the Spillway Dam. Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The U.S. Supreme Court majority's April 29th Calais decision invalidated use of race for redistricting and sent some GOP-led states running to redraw congressional maps to dilute black voting power. August 11th, Alabama ran a second state primary with its restored discriminatory maps. When the Supreme Court ruled on Calais, early voting for Alabama's May 19th primary had already begun using Voting Rights Act compliant maps. Alabama then asked to restore a 2023 legislature-drawn map found twice by courts to be discriminatory. But the U.S. Supreme Court allowed it anyway, possibly eliminating the chance of a black congressional candidate being elected in a state with a 27% population of African Americans. Governor Kay Ivey called a special session to redistrict, invalidated already cast congressional votes in 4 districts, and called the special primary election. The Alabama Reflector reports the August 11th primary advanced Republican Jerry Carl and incumbent Democrat Clyde Jones Jr. in District 1. In the now GOP-leaning District 2, Republican Rhett Marks will face U.S. Representative Shamari Figures. In GOP stronghold District 6, U.S. Representative Gary Palmer will be challenged by Democrat Maurice Mercer. In the only competitive congressional district, Democrat Terry Sewell and Republican Amy Akin will compete in November. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to KMUN.